Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this week's photo show. As you can see, we have a full house tonight, not only our resident experts, but we've also got Andy Gray joining us tonight to discuss his particular brand of photography, which is falls under the brand of ICM. Now, that's not intercontinental ballistic missile. It's called intentional camera movement, as opposed to mine, which is involuntary camera movement. But I'm sure Andy can explain that more in detail. So good evening all. Let me start off with good evening, Ian. How are you doing?
Very well. Yeah, just had a week off. That's not the Mediterranean behind me. That was actually Cornwall. So I had the right week off this week.
Very nice.
Bit of a heat wave down there.
Yeah, I see where you kept that for when we weren't down there, but we won't go harking on about that. Yeah. Good evening, Damien. How are you?
Very, very good. And my picture is because we're off to Scotland in a couple of weeks' time, and we got some new boots to do some walking. And I've never been to the hills. I've been to Malvern, but I've never been to Malvern Hills and walked them. So that's British camp. And I'm going to go back. I've really enjoyed myself.
Yeah. As opposed to yesterday, you sent us to Coventry. So I appreciate that. That's very interesting. As you can see, Mighty Mouse ears. This was, we went round the Coventry Transport Museum, and this is Thrust SSC, I think it was called. The museum is very good, but they've got all three of the land speed record cars there. So if you've got a couple of hours to spend, it's well worth having a look in. And who else we've got? Neil. Hello. Good evening, Neil.
Hi.
It's funny, Switzerland, I hear.
No, I'm in the UK. I made it over on Friday night, day zero for me. I'm now on day two of my mandatory quarantine and enjoying this rainy weather we have.
Yeah, see, we recorded it on a good day. As you imagine, by the end of the 5 days, you'd be tearing and going, I want to do this. You know? So, take it easy.
Well,
and get through
they're taking care of me. The UK government are calling me every day just to make sure I'm okay.
Good to hear. And they always start off by saying, how are you today?
No, they don't. And my challenge tomorrow is to keep them on the phone as long as I can.
And then finally, our guest tonight, Andrew Gray. Andy is a photographer based up in Northumberland, wasn't it? You were saying, Andy?
I am. Hello, everybody.
All right.
Yes, up in the sunny climes of Northumberland. Usually it's the other way on. So the south gets the hot weather. We get all the wet weather. But this week it's been blistering for this pale northerner.
Yeah, we have had some quite extraordinary weather for the last couple of weeks all over the place. Though I must admit, we had a cracking thunderstorm the other night. My goodness me, I didn't think we were going to survive it. It was right overhead, so none of this counting, flash, one, two, three. No, it was almost overhead, so we really got a downpour. Okay, so before we get on to talking to Andy and going through with his photography, we're going to do our usual sections on both news and gear. In the news in the last few weeks since we last seen you all, I believe we were mentioned in the last show about the we were talking about the new R3 and whether it would be released in time for the Olympics. The other actually we saw was this article here. You can see the link to it about Canon at the Olympics and the stock of equipment that they supply or make available to the photographers at the Olympics. Damon, you saw this article about the amount of Canon equipment at the Olympics. Do you want to tell us a bit more that you found out?
I was just looking for a news for the show, and I was just thinking about looking at photography of the Olympics, and Jeff's website came up, and it was all about him using his using the Canon cameras on a monopod to do the opening ceremony. And what was really interesting was that he said that he's not looked after, that he's got a program, he knows what's happening. He was just taking interesting pictures as they came along, and he did say that one or two of his pictures were blurred, and I had to have a real close look to see the blurring that he was complaining about. But the storytelling of it was quite interesting, and I got lost into his site for about 5-10 minutes. But I didn't see that as we were having a pre-talk about it, all the equipment that Canon make available, but certainly had a really super duper zoom lens to catch the action. And then he's not only sending it back to news networks, but he's making a blog about it at the time as well. And it was just really interesting. And then it got me thinking about what's going to be the picture of the Olympics. You know, what sort of pictures will come out from the Olympics as they get moving? You know, they got no Usain Bolt to take pictures of this time. Or
funny you say that, Damo, and it's a very nice link. There is a site here which shows 15 of the top photographs taken during the Olympics. So if you want to catch up on them, and there he is, there's Usain Bolt smiling his head off as he walked away with the race. It's just impressive. So if you want to have a look there, you'll see some of these great photographs.
And there was a great moonshot that Neil might remember, where they got the moon with the five rings and they called it the sixth ring.
Someone jokingly said the IOC were going to sue the moon.
Yeah, that's right.
For the branding.
But timing is everything. If you look at all those pictures, it's all about timing and being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you can't predict it either. It's you just happen to get that photo with that image. You go to take an image, and then you when you look, you're surprised sometimes with the expression.
Yeah,
I think there was photograph taken in the London Olympics when Usain Bolt was crossing the line, and there was a lightning bolt appeared above the stadium exactly at the point he was taking the win, and the photographer just obviously was banging away on multiple take and just called it at exactly the right time. But did you have a look at the article about the hire, Ian?
No, I haven't. I was just going to say that. I mean, you know, we joke about, you know, all these camera releases with 20 and, you know, 30 frames a second, but, you know, this is what it's for, and these are the professionals that are using those insane frame rates in the hope of getting something.
Yeah, they have banks of cameras set up, hooked up direct to internet connections that, you know, transfer them off to an office full of people to go through them. And I think I remember something from the last Olympics. They said they within a minute they could have an image out onto the news network.
Yeah,
it's insane.
It's 2015.
Oh, that was clever. Thank you very much for that.
In case you wonder what time
was that, the timing was that.
All right, Siri, you're going out the window in a second, I tell you. Right. Yeah, unfortunately, with my sort of take on that kind of picture, I would have taken the picture just before the lightning flash and just after. It would have been perfectly bracketed, so I didn't get it. So, you know, got to work on that. Okay. No, I was just, I think you mentioned it was like an Aladdin's cave or a sweet shop with all the lenses and bodies and everything that was there. I could happily lose myself in there for some time. Okay, let's move on to our next item.
Actually, it reminds me of the photo show. I think 2-3 years ago, Canon had their long lenses on the top of the stand on an elevator stand. And I must have spent about 10-15 minutes just looking at people around the show, zooming in, and then sort of stopped after I realized I was getting quite sort of, you know, peeping Tom looking at everything.
I thought for a second there you were going to say you spent £10,000 or £15,000 on a new lens.
No.
We know how you like to buy your kit, Damien. Right. Okay. The other item I wanted to do have a look at tonight was this IPPA awards, and these are set out for photographs taken on iPhones and iPhones only. You had a look at this, Ian. What did you think?
Yeah, I think there's some great images in there. I mean, they've been going a while now. I think it's 2007 they started out.
Yeah, this is the 14th award ceremony.
Yeah, I was just thinking earlier, is it still relevant? You know, these iPhones are so good now that do they need their own competition? You know, to segregate them.
Good point.
They do for the manufacturer. That's the answer to that.
I'm sure there is a little bit of Apple behind it.
Well, I mean, it'll keep going, won't it? And because, it, you know, obviously people pay to enter and all that, and so it's going to keep going. But, I mean, you know, you can't really, can you tell a difference now between a shot taken on the phone? You know, it's a discussion that we've had loads of times. Can you tell a difference between a shot taken on a phone compared to a shot taken on a mirrorless camera or a digital SLR?
It's interesting.
The line's blurred, isn't it?
When you enter a photograph into a competition, often you have to limit the either the horizontal or the vertical pixel to say 2,000 or 2,500 pixels. So in doing that, you know, these iPhone pictures are very comparable quite often.
Yeah, and I think when the competition started out, you know, you didn't have night mode or portrait mode or all these things that have been added to iPhone since, you know, all the computational stuff. So I think in 2007, taking a shot on an iPhone was something a little bit different, a bit more skillful, because you had to work with the limitations of the technology then. But I think what the way things have progressed, I just think, is it still relevant as a competition? That was, there's no doubt the images are brilliant.
The interesting thing, Ian, if you look at some of these images that I'm going to show up, some of them were taken on iPhone 5s and iPhone 7s. There's only out of all of them, there's only a handful which were really taken on the new 12 Pro or anything like that. So it just goes to show that these cameras can take a good photograph, you know, going back, you know, what, several generations of previous cameras. Do you ever use an iPhone at all, Andy? Is that anything you get involved with?
I don't have the finances for Apple products. So I mainly just for record shots. You know, for places I've been to, or for, you know, ease of use to put it back into my Google account without putting cards into things.
Yeah,
that's the kind of use I use a mobile for photography. Usually because the phones are that cheap that I'm buying the base, you know, the budget range. So the camera is usually the bit that suffers. So it's not usually that great, like dynamic range and that kind of thing.
So says the man who buys all the Nikon gear. Okay, fair enough then. Yeah, right. Okay. I think I'm like yourself though. I'll if I'm out with the big boy camera, I'll often use the phone just to take a photograph of where I am, because the GPS is so good on it. And my camera doesn't have GPS. So it does mean I can actually, when I'm then putting all the pictures into Aperture, which I still use, I can then batch the whole lot as to the location and date and time and all that kind of stuff.
The other reason I use a phone shot for mine is because the stuff on the big camera, a lot of the time I can't really tell where it was.
Yeah, I've used it. So the shop behind me, I've used it as the iPhone that I have as a record of where the tripod is, because I'm taking a number of shots from this same point throughout the year. Yeah. When I go back, it all looks so different. It's hard to really put the camera in the same place.
Yeah, useful. But I said there's some very good shots there, which I suppose comes down to if you're a good photographer. It doesn't matter what kit you've got. You're going to get a good photograph. But yeah, interesting for people to have a look-see, and so that if they're thinking the iPhone is the only camera I've got, there's still room there to take some great photographs, and some of these are well impressive. Okay, and the last item of our news that we wanted to talk about was, there was an article here, I'll show you up the website. It's called Post Photography Era. And they're talking about the advancements now in obviously AI and computer graphics and software ability. That they're saying that if you can create a 3D image of an object, then you can manipulate that and make it much easier to photograph or take a so-called image shot of it by manipulation of the computer software, and hence all us photographers would be out of a job or out of a hobby. Ian, you had a chance to have a look at this?
Yeah, of course, an interesting article. And I think you already see it, don't you, in some TV advertising that, where, you know, the product looks computer generated. And that's what this article was saying, was, you know, you could take a product, whatever it be, you know, a bottle of gin or something, produce it in 3D. And once you've produced it once, yeah, the initial costs might be more than taking a photograph, but you haven't got to deal with, you know, dust spots, cleaning the product up, you know, etc., etc. And then once you've made the 3D model, you can put it in any environment you want, any lighting scenario. And yeah, it seems like a sort of a more economical way of doing it. And I think we're already seeing that. I mean, even with some of Apple's stuff, I wonder if some of that's sometimes computer generated, and some of their product shots that sometimes look so clean and perfect that I think, well, yeah, is that just computer generated rather than a shot of a picture of an iMac that they've been swirling around, etc., etc.
Yeah, so, I mean, when it comes to like advertising budgets, they have got the money to be able to throw at this kind of technology. Maybe it's not even just photography, is possibly heading towards the end of its era. If you think about film as well, when you've got Disney making The Mandalorian inside basically a big, what they call it, the volume, and it's just like big screens, and everything on it is using the Unreal Engine, which is like a computer games generated engine that they make computer like games from. I think that's been upgraded the fifth generation. And inside this volume, it also includes lighting. So they don't have to wait until the light to hit at the, you know, the right part of the golden hour or whatever. You know, they can just hit the switch, project this on, and it's projecting onto the actors that are standing on this 10-foot square bit of studio. And that could be anywhere in the world, or in the Mandalorian's case, anywhere in the Star Wars galaxy. You know, remarkable what they can do now. So it's probably only going to get worse.
Well, my daytime job is I'm involved with architectural design and layouts for office structure and stuff like that. And the abilities now in both ARCHICAD and AutoCAD to produce renders and fly-throughs and walk-throughs is stupendous. We also use a thing called Cinema 3D. And the amount of work that you can show, we can change a scene from midsummer, midwinter, autumn. You can place the building in any position. You can place it in its natural position. You can throw in then the sunlight, and you can see how the sun will track through the building on a day or weekly basis. And that stuff is funny if that's been general. You mentioned it there earlier on, Andy, about the games industry. And I feel that things like ARCHICAD and AutoCAD have followed the games industry, and they're using so much of their technique now to make the products better, which of course has meant that all the computers we're running on now have to be the most powerful we can find to cope with all this render work that they're trying to throw at it. So, but I'm sure will the digital photography, will it ever have the artistic look of, say, something that you do, Andy, or Damien or Ian, the stuff that you work on, that can that ever be achieved?
I think that it won't do. There's still got a long way for the that moment, that the spontaneity of life. I mean, our computer's not going to catch the spontaneity. It won't see the future and know where things are. And so there'll always be people around and catching images. I mean, for the storytelling like The Mandalorian, yes, I mean, I can see that's going to stay and get even better and better, but it's going to be pre-planned. So there'll still be room for the photography. It's just the background of it, that spontaneity.
I think it's probably a usage case as well. You know, yeah. The advertising, the movie, you know, for photography to do with like movie backgrounds or whatever for making these projections. That's where that'll probably come in. Our own photography of street photography or, you know, landscape photography, that kind of thing. It's still down to us. Mm. It's going to be a while before we can replicate all this kind of stuff in a computer. Companies can do it now, big multi-billion worth companies, but the average Joe with a camera, you know, that it's going to be a while before it that sets into having an impact in photography in general.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned it, Ian, is product placement and product photography could be the one area that really would impact big time on, that you could, yeah, you can use even a LiDAR sensor on the phone now to 3D model something. And I say, once you've cleaned that up and made it look respectable, you can practically do anything you want with it. So
yeah, I mean, it's not going to replace, you know, Damo's experience of climbing a hill and getting the camera out.
Yeah,
you know, you can't replace that, I don't think.
Well, and certainly not his reflections. You'll never go. I don't think you'll ever see that done. You know, right.
Okay, so interesting. Has anyone played around with IKEA where you can place their? Well, it's interesting reading in the article. They're already 3D models. They're not even photos. So, you know, even their furniture, they've not gone through the process of, you know, photographing it from all different angles. And
it's
3D rendered.
Six years ago when we bought our house, when it was being built, because it was being built, we had to try and imagine what size the rooms were. So I was off with a broken ankle. So I modeled the house in a bit of free software. And that was okay. Whilst it was probably, certainly wasn't up to the Mandalorian standards for sure, but it was really useful in deciding, you know, what furniture we had, where it might go, all that sort of stuff. And I could then, you know, I could show my wife, you know, you'd turn it this way, that way, it would look like this. And it was a little bit time consuming, but very useful to do. And so, yeah, there's plenty of places for this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And my wife goes, why are you not showing me this room? Well, because that's going to be my photography studio.
And of course, if you want to have a real laugh, go downstairs, photograph your old stuffy armchair, go to the IKEA store and see where you can place it in their nicely laid out rooms and see if it fits anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. As we say each week, if there's any news items out there that you've seen that you think we should be aware of, please send them in. Please send the link in to myself and we'll bring it up and get the guys talk it through on the show. So for tonight's foray into gear and kit, we're going to be looking at a couple of Nikons, because we have a Nikon guest tonight, especially for him. The other thing we're going to look at is a new book. Damo, you saw this. Do we all have to stand up at this point?
No, I saw it in the Amateur Photographer, and then I looked at the website, and I'd quite like that. It's just the family pictorial history of a person, happens to be the Queen, and all the photographers that got involved in taking pictures of her. It's just really good sort of page turning to me, anyhow, seeing the differences and all the way that there's nothing more that I like is taking a good family picture every year. And I always fascinated how people get lined up in family pictures and stuff like that. And we've had last year's family picture couldn't happen at the Christmas time, so I had to sort of engineer it to be with different pictures from different webcams to bring the family together. But I quite like the fact that it's got, you know, got like the Royal Yacht Britannia and the trips aboard and the different cultures, the styles. So yeah, it's a book I might buy. I know some people would be put off by it, but I quite like the narrative in a photography story like that, and all the people who got involved in it. I think it's 50 quid, and I think I may well go for it.
Yeah, it's strange. Someone said this to me the other day. We were talking about it, that no one under, what is it, 68 has ever known anything other than the Queen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the thought of God Save the King is going to be so alien to almost the entire population. That'll be quite strange. Yeah, it looks an interesting book. Obviously, it's quite high quality from what I can see from the bits here that you see here in the link. So yeah, if that's your particular interest, I don't see that as being a bad investment. Our resident book buyer, Ian, are you going to be buying a half dozen copies of this? I know you're always looking at good photography books.
No, not for me. I've never been into the Royals.
I like, as Damon said, though, I like the idea. We've discussed this before, guys. I know we're going back over stuff. But that whole process of taking a photograph of the family through a course of years to watch that family grow and change and expand and shrink, it is quite fascinating, as well as the backgrounds, you know, everyone's house changes every so often. I know somewhere between 5 and 10 years, you see new furniture, new wallpaper, new bits of kit. That can be quite a social comment about what's gone on over the years. But I don't think you have to be a royalist, but yeah, it's an interesting book if that's...
Well, there's a fair few famous photographers have been in there, so I think you can learn a few tips from how they set things out and did things. So and I do like the narrative. The it's not street photography, it's not travel, it's the reporting photography that they've done of it, the news photography.
And at this point now, Neil, you get a chance. I know you've been patiently waiting for this to come home, but we've got the new Nikons to discuss. Is it the, what's it called? Yeah, the ZFC and some new lenses?
Yeah, Nikon brought out another crop sensor camera, but rather than going for the same sort of Nikon Z styling, they've gone a bit retro with this one. I have to say, it does look quite nice. It really represents the old sort of film camera with the dials on top, and it's nice silver and black, giving that sort of almost like encased look. They brought it out with a couple of different lenses, a 28mm, 40mm, and I think the other one's something like a 16 to 50, I think it is. What's it, 56, something like that. It looks a nice bit of kit. It's similar specs to the Z50 that's already out there. So crop sensor, 21 megapixels, 11 frames a second, 4K video. It does all your eye face detection sort of stuff as well. So it seems a really nice compact camera. Certainly for street photography, that sort of thing, with a 28mm lens, which is what, equivalent of 40, I think. For full frame, it's a lovely bit of kit, and it's been so well accepted that actually the demand has outstripped the supply. So later this week, the first ones are meant to be delivered, and they haven't got enough to go around. So there's going to be a delay on delivering some of these. The thousands, not the 20 odd that Ian thinks.
Yeah, might have been ordered. I do have a problem with that though, because and I'm not trying to bash Nikon, but you know, we don't know how many they expected to sell. If they massively underproduce, then they are going to potentially outstrip demand. You know, if however they thought they were going to sell a million, and you know they're 10 million pre-orders, then fair enough. But we don't know if they just played it safe and you know only manufactured 100,000 and you know had 500,000 pre-orders. Do you know what I mean?
I think there's two things come into play here as well. So I know from something I've been trying to buy that's not arrived and it's delayed another 2 months because of chip shortages. I know that the massive world chip shortage has probably limited the number they can produce. So it's probably partly to do with that as well. They're still having trouble even supplying lenses for certain cameras. So it's probably partly to do with that. But I'm sure they planned to sell millions, Ian,
I mean, I actually think it's a really nice looking camera, really, really nice. And it harks back to the Fuji XT series, doesn't it?
Right, The cynical of me thinks they're moving into to go into the Leica Fuji film.
Yeah, but to be fair to Nikon, it's modelled on their original film series, isn't it? So they're not they're not copying anyone. They're harping back to their own roots, to be fair, but it just looks very similar.
Yeah, they're regurgitating their old bodies from the 60s, 70s and all that kind of stuff, aren't they? Is anybody disappointed that it's not full frame?
Yeah. So what mount is on that, Neil?
That's a Z mount. So it's a mirrorless camera with the Z mount, the same as the Z50, was it the Z55 to 6 to 7? And of course, we've got the Z9, which may be at the Olympics, I would imagine. It's the top end camera that's out there in the field being tested at the moment, due for release later in the year.
So the Z mount lenses that you've got would fit this, but obviously you get the crop factor in the, is it about a 1.6 multiplier?
1.4, I think it is.
1.4, yeah. Okay. I must admit, it does break the style line that everyone's been following down about these black amorphic cameras. The only camera I had that was anything similar to that was the old AE one, the Canon AE one, which had a similar kind of style and look to it. So yeah, it is a good looking camera because it's different. It harks back to a previous kind of style. And I suppose it has all of the Nikon attributes. Andy, would you look at one of these, or is it something you think about?
Well, the budget wise, no. But the other thing for me is the ergonomics of it. I wouldn't be able to throw that around. I need to be holding on to something quite sturdily for what I do. And that, just from playing with my film camera, my Pentax thing that I've got, it's not comfortable to hold. And I certainly got no confidence for flailing my arms around. So I do need something that I can hold on to very tightly. And for a longer period of time as well. So
it seems to be an intriguing insight to what about we do. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's the intention. That's the intentional bit, Martin, not the the unintentional.
Yeah, involuntary, as I call it. Yes, yeah. That's
right. If Nikon go retro, the one that I really love was one of their first digital cameras, which were the twist ones, the 500 or the 750s, I think they were. The first digital cameras that I had with the Nikon one. I really like that twist body. It was really clever. That'll come back sometime.
The screen on this, you can not only just flip it out, but you can turn the thing completely round. So for bloggers or vloggers, I should say, it's very good.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm intrigued. Neil said he was waiting for something. So what's he been buying now?
Now I picked up a real bargain, a Z7 that was brand spanking new in the box, still with its guarantee, for an absolute snip of a price. Real snip of a price. I reckon that if I'd brought it over in the box, I could probably have rocked up to Wex and sold it to them and made a profit.
Really?
So how does that compare? So you were Z6 before you?
I've still got the Z6, Z7.
Are they both full frame though, aren't they?
Both full frame. The difference is the megapixels. That's the only difference. But what, for me now, the big thing for me having glasses all the time is the electronic viewfinder. That for me is a huge thing, being able to look at what I've shot through the viewfinder without having to grab for the glasses.
Okay, yeah.
That is really valuable. And you can zoom in on it as well. So if you want to see if something's pin sharp, it's very easy.
I was out with a mate yesterday that wears glasses for reading, and he's got a Canon like me, and we're doing some macro stuff, and every other shot it's like, take a shot, right, get the glasses out, put the glasses on.
He wants an electronic viewfinder.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
I'm a little bit concerned, Neil, that you're saying on one hand you got this camera at Snip, and you suddenly appeared back in this country. Are you going to be able to go back to Switzerland? You have not. nothing naughty's gone on, I hope. We don't.
No, it's already booked.
Good man. Okay. And the last thing I want to have a quick look at, we saw this lens. Ian, you had a look at it as well. Forgive me, people, if I murder this as well. I think it's called a Lauer 14mm lens. What did you think of this?
Yeah, just very quickly. I mean, it's one of these, they've done it, I think, I don't think it's a new lens. I think they've just brought it to the full frame mount for the Nikon and Canon. But it's what they call a zero distortion. So normally at 14mm, trying to control distortion is a nightmare. And they're claiming it's zero distortion. And looking at some of the images and the review, the cityscapes, the verticals are lovely and lovely and straight. I mean,
I have the 12mm version of this.
Yeah,
and 12mm 2.8.
A couple of things that stuck out to me were the price. I mean, for a 14mm f/4 lens, I think it retails at $499, so it's not particularly expensive. It's quite lightweight. It takes a filter thread, so typically your really wide lenses. I mean, I've got a Tamron 15-30, and the glass on that is like a massive dome, and you can't get any filters or anything like this. It's just so bulbous. But this still accommodates filter threads. And the other thing that I was really fascinated with, because I always struggle with this, is on my 15 to 30. Well, not just my 15 to 30, but the infinity point is never the infinity point. And if you are doing stars and stuff and fumbling around in the dark, trying to find infinity sometimes is a right nightmare. What you can do on this lens is you can, it's got like a screw mechanism on it where you can loosen it, find infinity, and lock it in, so that next time when you need to find infinity, you sort of pre-registered it. I've never heard of that on a lens before, so I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
For the price. Yeah. Interesting lens.
And I don't know the make. You said you've got one of these lenses, Neil. It's a make I don't know. Are they a good make? Are they reliable?
Well, we reviewed it once before, and it's a manual lens. And yeah, it's been very good. This picture behind me is taken with it. I like it. If you don't get it straight on with the, certainly with the 12, it was quite a bulbous lens on the front. If you don't get it straight on and you're tipped down or slightly to the side in any way, you do start to see the barreling. You really have to be straight on to whatever the subject is.
Yeah. I mean, that's just physics, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
When you start, if you, rather than think about the lens, if you think about the sensor, if you've got trees here or buildings nice and straight and the sensor, as soon as you start tilting the sensor, you're changing the distortion. So that's sort of just physics rather than the glass. But,
Okay. But I like using it a lot.
I have to see if we can get hold of one to have a look at, as we always used to try and say. Yeah, and ask.
They might send us one. You never know.
You never know. Okay. I think that covers the kit we've seen. I'm not even going to go into the rumours of the R1. Okay. Let's take a break at this point. So in the last part of the show, we're going to be talking to Andy and his use of the technique called attentional camera movement to produce some of the images that we're going to be looking at. So Andy, tell us a little bit about how you got into this style. What was it brought in? Where did you pick up the idea from before we actually look at some of your images?
Well, I mean, a lot of it started because of kind of almost like restrictions. We've all been living with restrictions recently, but like financial restrictions, I don't particularly like traveling restrictions, but wanting to be a landscape photographer means you should really kind of get out and about, but I kind of haven't. So I do live in a beautiful part of the country near the coast here in Northumberland. So we have iconic places like Bamborough Castle, Dunsinbrough Castle, we're not far away from the border of Scotland, so we've got all these lovely places. Fantastic to live here and photograph a lot. It's beautiful all year round, but when you've never left the county for maybe 4 or 5 years and you want to be a professional photographer, your subject matter is a bit limited. So after photographing Bamborough Castle in the snow with lightning, with aurora, foggy days, sunny days, all this kind of stuff, you kind of getting a bit stuck. And I think it was about 2013. I was kind of starting to think about, what other styles of photography out there is there? I'd done a lot of long exposure work, and I'd done a lot of, that black and white architectural kind of photography that seemed to be very popular around about that time. So I'd done quite a lot of that, so I always knew quite a bit about Photoshop and that kind of stuff. And I happened across the work of Valda Bailey down in, I think she's Sussex Way. She was doing like ICM photography along with multiple exposures. And she was using the Canon 5D Mark III, which did these things in camera. And I was just really intrigued because, up to that point, you see photography online, you kind of tend to know exactly how it was taken. But the stuff she was producing, it would just had me flummoxed. I like, did not have a clue how she did what she did. I kind of found out it was ICM photography mixed in with multiple exposures. And my camera at the time, the Nikon D700, does have multiple exposures, but it's like a singular blend mode. It's like an average blend mode. Whereas the Canon 5D Mark III had darken and lighten blend modes. So it created these like almost oil painting kind of textures when you do a bit of a camera shake and blend these things together. But I knew my Photoshop and I knew about layers and layer blending within Photoshop. So I did images of shaking the camera around and blending those together. And that's kind of how I progressed into ICM photography in a big way. Really just kind of fell for it. And it was something that I think everybody starts off in photography having a go at this and that, little bits of everything, and kind of fall into a niche. And I very much fell into my niche of ICM. And, you know, it's enabled us to, you know, create a little bit of a name for myself, and being one of the proponents that people seek out to, you know, learn how to do it or get guidance about how to do it, you know, through YouTube and all that kind of stuff.
So Andy, that explains how we got there. And a lot of people, once they see these images, are going to be thinking, like you must have thought back then, how the hell do you get to that shot? So let's call up one of your images. This is called Abs, so people can see it on the show now. So can you walk us through this and tell the viewers how we managed to, how you managed to get to that image?
Well, this image of a cottage overlooking St. Abbs Harbour, just up in Scotland there. This is what I would call a simple ICM photograph, because it is a single image. There's none of this fancy blending that I do most, you know, 99% of the time. This is a single ICM image that generally a lot of people will do when they're first having a go at ICM photography. Where they were, you know, the maybes go down to the coast, aim the camera out to sea, and maybes move left and right, and then you get that lovely clean line, or they disappear into the woods and find some trees in front of them, and they'll move the camera up and down and get that, you know, lovely straight lines of tree, you know, possibly pine trees, because they all tend to be straight and easy to follow. That's the kind of photography that a lot of, you know, the beginners of ICM photography make. Whereas this one of St. Abbs is, it's using a technique that, instead of, you know, moving, say, the camera in one particular way, say left and right or up and down, I'm doing like multiple movements during the art of capture. So obviously ICM photography is the light hitting the sensor whilst the aperture is open. So it's effectively long exposure. Instead of it being tied down on a tripod, it is, you know, it's in your hand, and all the movement that you're doing has an effect on the shapes that the camera is capturing in front of you. So this image of St. Abbs, you can see the cottage in the middle there, and basically what I've done there is tried to isolate the cottage as best as I could by moving light around the rest of the frame. So, you know, the sky at the top there, that bleeds into the foreground by twisting the camera in a way, and it's all to do with a bit of timing and a hell of a lot of experimentation and years of honing the movements to have any kind of replayability, to be able to do it with any kind of confidence.
Yeah, I was going to say, what sort of exposure time is that shot then, Andy?
I don't know specifically without actually going and finding the file and right-clicking it to find out. But generally, I tend to be, you know, anything from a fifth of a second up to a second, you know, that kind of range. I think when I first started, I was going as long as 5 seconds, and then it just becomes a bit of a mess. Yeah. But over time, I've kind of brought
it's quite
that
a
down.
Quick movement then.
You
haven't got a lot of time to do what you need to do.
The other thing with this is almost the camera manufacturers are almost not quite making it harder, but these better cameras and their better sensors, which are probably built for people to almost guarantee a good shot, the sensor is rendering whatever's in front of it very, very quickly. So I've noticed with the new camera that I've got earlier this year, the D850, Nikon D850, is that captures the imprint of the landscape in front of you a lot quicker than the D700 does. So I've got to be very quick off the mark. So it's press the shutter and almost got to be in movement as I'm pressing the shutter, just so it doesn't become too sharp and too blocky. So there's a bit of drag in initially to give that almost painterly texture to it. I must admit it's easier to demonstrate and than actually try to explain it. But it's there is a lot of timing problems to get these going right.
And have you always done this digitally? Would this work on film?
It will work on film. I mean, not the blending. Well, the blending side you could do in post later on. But I was made aware of a photographer, Ernest Haas, who did like a motion series back in the 50s. I think there's a famous shot of a bullfighter and a bull, and it's just a bit of shutter drag. And you can see the movement in it. It's been there for a long time. But obviously the advent of digital is it doesn't cost you a fortune in film. Because I do generally throw away, well, not throw away, but disregard probably 80% of the images that I take. And over time you realize which images will work to be able to blend together to create something later on. Doing it with film, I have shot one frame using film a while back, but I am still very, very young in my film photography career at the moment.
I envy you only throwing away 80%, about 98% of mine gets thrown away, but I'll go into that. So let's have a look at another one. Again, this is starting, you're saying this is a slightly more complex one. So this is what, Eve of Mankind, you've called this.
Yeah, this is one where we can get into the extent of how much editing I do. The first shot was pretty much almost straight out of camera as well. But this Eve of Mankind one is where you can, with this technique, it's a bit painterly. You can start kind of telling stories within it, really. And there's another example of one of the ones we'll be looking at as well. This one, the amount of editing I do, like layering different images on top of each other. This one was, it was like a 7-hour edit to get to this point. And a lot of the time, if you ever watch my YouTube channel, I do live streams on that every week. And so I go through the whole editing process. You can see, if you're watching any of that, you'll know for a fact, I don't really have a preconceived idea of what I do when I start, of how it's going to end up. I'm almost, relying on how the combinations come together to push the image on further. And this one just came about. It's almost termed as the Northumbrian Stonehenge. It's a stone circle that's not too far away from us. And that was actually made on a bright blue sunny sky day for all the, all that editing and the combination and turning things upside down brought about that stormy sky, and then as I was editing that bright spot appeared, at which point that was the point where I was like, oh, right, there's a story here. It's the sun setting, and because it's a stone circle and stone circles were made by early man, the way mankind's going at the moment, we could be near the end of it. That's where the title of it all came about. Yeah. That's just an example of some of the extensive, editing and layering that I do can be done to end up, bringing all, a little bit of a story together. It's one of these people when people look at me work, the name Turner is bandied around, and so I've brought in a lot of inspiration from his work in color schemes and that kind of stuff.
So when you blend a number of images, is Is there, is it typically sort of 3 or 4, or does it just however it feels? And is it the same?
I mean, it is however it feels. I tend to start with 5.
Yeah.
Just one of them happy things that happen. I've gone as low as blending 2 together without a problem. I've probably gone as 5, 7, and 9. But when you get that many layered together, you start getting, the data starts getting a bit compressed and dark, and then you never really get that back. So, you 5 seems to be the happy medium. Obviously, if it's a bright, if it's a lighter image, you can do more, and if it's a darker one, I'm struggling.
Is it typically when you say you're blending 5 images, are those images, for want of a better word, your standard type of landscape image, which then with your method you're then creating this ICM from it?
Yeah,
I mean, are they intentional movement images to start with?
They are all movement images to start with. They'll be, when I mix them together, there'll be maybe some that are very, very loose. So they'll, very, free of any kind of form or just hints of it. And then some will be, taken where I've just really small movements of the camera, and that will retain, say, like windows in a building. So you've got that, maybe like that dark little streak that to give the impression of a window, or a stronger edge to whatever building is in front of us, or the edge of a tree. So you can combine those like almost ethereal kind of images along with some of the detail stuff and blend those together, and gives you a nice bit of texture to work on. So it's quite a mix of there's lots of things to go wrong. It's about how you pull it back together.
I couldn't even imagine where I'd start on that. Let's have a look at another one, Andy. This one here we're going to look at is called The Great Whale.
Right. I mean, this is a good example.
I can see it in this one. Do you want to talk us through this one?
This is one that the last one, it came about as I was editing. I think I actually made this one in a live stream. No idea what episode it was for you to find, but just going through it, throwing in some, inverted color. So that's where the pinks come from. And then realizing that there was, when I've inverted it, there's been that white streak. And then by rotating that, add the doubled up exposure above it, and it makes it look like a whale's tail.
Mm.
Fantastic. So you can create, again, creating your own little story about it and how it's come about. And off the top of my head, I think the starting subject was actually Bamborough Castle. So that's quite a bit of a change to get to that, and I can't even remember what kind of time of the day it was or anything like that. But it's ended up pinky and orangey and white, and I mean it's lots and lots of experimentation in Photoshop, and doing weird and wonderful things to get weird and wonderful results. But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, certainly unusual. It's not something I've personally ever come across before. You say that you do like a kind of masterclass in this that on your website. You can follow the process for guys and people who want to take this further.
The processing side of stuff. I do a live stream pretty much every Tuesday evening here in the UK, and anybody's free to watch that and just come along for have a bit of a chat with people in the chat room and that kind of stuff. And just every week I'll make a new image, okay, and just cram a few frames together and just basically see where it goes over the hour and a half or whatever it takes to pull something out of the fire.
I'll put that link for that here on the screen now for people who might want to follow up on that.
I went into your website, Andy, and I saw your latest picture, which I suppose is the one that I liked because I got a bit more out of it being traditional, and it was nice with the sparkly bits on the water.
Yeah.
In the background, I could see some hills. So I could make my story up on, and where the other pictures, I'd have to be guided by the title. But that one, I really like that one of your latest picture. Now, is that you hankering back to a more traditional, or is that just, how did that one come about?
I think that one, it was just a case, it was such a bright, sunny day. And I was really attracted by the reflection of the water, of the light in the water. That was
my attention very much, the reflection of the water.
That's what I was aiming for when I actually made the picture. The fact that there was things in the background didn't really, hit true. It's probably because I was using my 16-35mm lens at 35, and that's as wide as it would go, so that the background was there. And then bringing it together later on, you kind of, you see the pinnacle, the guidance pinnacles that are on the coast there in the background, and just the way the camera had caught them. So they weren't, they weren't precisely there. There was a little bit of drag. And so highlighting bits like that is.
But it anchored me into the story as I've been pulled into the picture, I think, really.
Yeah. I think it's not for everybody to, one, learn how to do it, and also to, appreciate it. Not everybody's into abstract painting. I'm a bit, when it comes to painted landscapes, I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I'm not one of these Picasso appreciatives and all this kind of stuff. I kind of stop at Monet is when it comes, when it comes to painted landscapes. And it's same with photography. There's a lot of abstract stuff out there which it's just way over the top of my head. So I do like leaving in a bit of realism. A lot of people do say that it's good that you leave something in that's recognizable to be able to latch onto something.
Yeah.
Examples today,
I'd like to ask Andy, so what sort of movement would that have been on that particular one image Damo's talking about? I mean, that's a kind of seascape, landscape type thing, but it's, you can obviously see kind of some movement in the light in the foreground.
Yeah, to capture those little light streaks, because they were so pretty. It was just very, very kind of stuttery kind of movement. So watching us on screen for the viewers, it was very just shaky movement like that, rather than some of the times I'm fleeing the camera all over the place. And just the way it's brought it together.
So the next one we're going to look at, Andy, is this one here, which is called Dawn Raiding. At Dawn Raiding, is that right?
At Dawn Raiding, yeah.
At Dawn Raiding, yes. This one I really like. This is great. So tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, this one is it's the famous Bamburgh Castle, and this place that I just can't seem to escape. And it's one of them images that it's an angle where it's on the village green, so right in down below the bulk of the building. And it's a good few years ago when I was starting this, I made a couple of decent stabs at this particular angle, but I don't like to repeat myself too much. And this one was just a case of let's photograph it from this angle, using all the movements and all that kind of stuff. But in editing, just throw in a obscure color. So just throw in, like a deep red, there's a magenta-y kind of, and throw that in as a layer and blend that in Photoshop. So it's colorizing whatever, the reddish, I'm saying it's reddish, like the orangey brickwork of the castle itself, making that a deeper red, and then processing it in my same usual way, and just basically seeing how it ends up. And again, like at the previous one of the stone circle, as I was editing, this kind of lighter area appeared. So just dropped in, a radial filter and made that lighter, and a bit of, luminosity masking and to enhance that. So, for all the sun was basically behind us, I've got a sunrise or a sunset kind of image out of it, just through a bit of manipulation and a bit of, letting the mind wander and letting the sliders on Photoshop wander even further, just to push things out and get, I like a bit of vivid color now and again, just to push the envelope out there.
I think your favorite time of day,
to be honest, I photograph most of these pretty much middle of the day. I'm not if I'm going out for sunrise or sunset, I'm tending to be attempting to photograph normally. I think it's just maybe the harsher light, or looking maybe, you know, looking into the harsher light at sunrise, sunset is harder to work with. There's probably more reflections and that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, high in the sky, sun's higher in the sky, you're less likely to catch it in frame as you're moving the camera around, because, you know, you can get pretty wild with it. So the worst thing you can get a light streak through your image. So whether that be car lights or a bit of a write-off. So I tend to put these things in later on.
Do you go, that first thing, image had a look of black and white about it. Do you do black and whites at all? I haven't looked at the site thoroughly.
For a while I classed myself as a black and white photographer. Since I've done ICM, it's been, you know, almost the mixing and playing around with colour that's been the attraction of the whole technique, just to make it harder. I've maybe made possibly two black and white ICM images out of the, you know, hundreds that I've made since I started this. So it's you know, the big attraction is playing around with colour. For me, is one of the big things.
Andy, I've just stumbled onto the previous life section of your website. I mean, not only are you good at the ICM stuff, but you were clearly, yeah, an accomplished photographer before then. Do you think that helps going into the ICM stuff and having that background knowledge?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you want a rough idea about compositions and, you know, being able to spot images to go out and take. But for me, a lot of the big thing was the extent of knowing how much Photoshop to get to some of these. I don't know what you're actually looking at there, but some of the more very fine detailed, like black and white stuff, some of the square crops that might be in there, that took hours and hours and hours of, you know, getting selections right and all this kind of stuff. Having that kind of background knowledge to be able to then use later on in the new technique, to really be able to, you know, jump into that with 2 feet, rather than, you know, a lot of the people that I do tutor, you know, that one of the main things they probably struggle with is the Photoshop side of stuff. You know, they can go out there and anybody can go out there and waft a camera around and come back and say they've got a.
That's me.
I've done some ICM photography, but it's then utilizing that to the best of their ability. And, you know, not everybody's as sad as me and spends 16 hours a day sat in front of a computer playing around in Photoshop. So it's, you know, I think the way it's all developed is, you know, do a reasonable knowledge of Photoshop since about version 4 or whatever. So I've been using it for 20 years or whatever it's been, over the years, and just knowing, building up my knowledge over that time. It certainly helped, and that'll be where it's driven it in certain directions.
I'm sure I could provide you with a wealth of basic photographs to start working with all the movement you could possibly want, Andy. But I think most of us looking at these images are really impressed with your Photoshop skills. There's some detail work gone in there that, to me personally, I wouldn't even know where to start, but I might have to come along and listen to one of your live shows and try and learn.
I think with Photoshop, you only need to know what you need to know. It is huge in that extent.
I've been trying to learn Photoshop for 20 years. I still don't know which layer I'm trying to use. Let's have a look at one more, which again, this is one I particularly liked. And this was Faltering Under the Fury. Now, am I right? Is that the castle in there? Have I picked up on it correctly?
There's a more extensive story of this. This one is based in 2014. I made an image that, to me, well, it was a series of images, to me looked like an old sailing ship that was in trouble because there was fire and stuff coming out of it. As I made this image, as it was coming together, I could see the story coming out. So a few years later, so this is 2017's version. I went back to the same location, same time of year, so like late July, early August, or whatever it was. So the sun was in the right place to get that fiery kind of look about it. And it was just one of those, it was like the original version was the one where I realized you could, out of whatever landscape was in front of you, you could, with movement and a bit of editing, realized you could actually start telling stories with it that was completely devoid of what was actually there in front of you. And this was a like a revisit to that location with better understanding in technique and the editing, because the original version was taken like 6, 7, 8 months after I started playing around with ICM photography. This was once I'd had 3 years under my belt, and a lot more confidence, a lot more refinement of the style. So, you know, managed to be able to push it further and refine the vision further. So this is probably one of my more favorite images. I just like the, you know, the massive contrast between, not scared about how dark it is on one, you know, one side. I think a lot of people would be quite worried about that. And also for this particular version, I got the old Wacom tablet out and a bit of Photoshop and painting bits in, you know, to highlight, certainly the bottom right-hand corner. There was a lot of that. That's all, you know, digitally painted in just to enhance the image further. And so, this image, you know, to me is an old sailing ship faltering at sea and about to, you know, collapse in a pile of flames and disappear to the bottom of the ocean. This is actually a tree in the field behind my house, just photographed as the sun was setting and all the movement and all that, and it just bringing everything together to create something. Hopefully, that's, you know, a little bit epic. Do like a little bit of epic now and again.
So, it's fascinating when you explain it in the way you do that you can actually start to see these stories that you're telling. It's very interesting.
I mean, the original version, I don't think it's on my website anymore, but I did put it out there when I first made it in 2013, because I could see the story in my head. So I put it online and said, right, I can see a certain story here. What can you see in this? And there was, you know, some creative interpretations of it. And of course, there's still, you know, there are a few boring ones where it's a tree.
Well, there's a challenge to our viewers. Maybe we could get some comments. What do you see in these photographs? Have a look at them, go back on them and see what you think. And by all means, send in your comments and send in what you think's in the pictures. That'll be an interesting way of passing that on to Andy.
Andy, you refer to it as an image rather than a photograph. I mean, at what point do you go from photography to art, if you don't mind me asking that question?
Yeah,
it's controversial, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But I mean, when you start multiple layers, painting bits of yourself.
It is a tricky one.
Do you consider it as art rather than photography at that point, or?
Because it started in a camera, I would still call it photography, even though like, you know, the act of taking it was, you know, a fraction of a second, and it's probably had, you know, 4 hours on it in Photoshop afterwards. You know, I suppose it's down to the viewer and any experts out there want to, you know, decide what it is. But to me, it started off in a camera, therefore, it's photography. I'm there to be convinced.
Yeah, I think you've got to be fair, describe it as a new form of photography. It's
not exactly many people doing this, so it's not something, you know, he did that, so therefore it's that. So.
Yeah, what I find fascinating is just, you know, I mean, I take thousands and thousands of images and it's never got anything with that kind of texture. Almost like how do pixels create that texture? I mean, it is fascinating. They, you know, it does look like, you know, something physical, brush strokes and stuff, rather than pixel data. It's quite.
I mean, this one that we've just been talking about, Faltering Under Fury. This particular version, I would definitely say this is way nearer digital art than what it is photograph, because of enhanced a good section of it. You know, with the Wacom tablet and a few painting tools in Photoshop.
How many layers would have been on that one, Andy? Can you think offhand?
The starting point would have been about 5, and then you're building up from there, you know, curves adjustment layers, hue and saturation layers. And then I use the Nick collection, the Analog Effects Pro in the Nick collection to do some jiggery pokery in that. There's various sliders in that. And a lot of in the Nick collection, there's a like tonality, because it's to do with old photography and mimicking that. There's some lovely tones come out of that from that you would get from older film, and that, and kind of gives you the impression of like maybe an 1800s painting rather than a, you know, applied to this style, kind of gives it a different older kind of feel. And then there's, you know, further adjustments down the road. So it could get quite messy in the old panel of layers in Photoshop.
Guys, any other questions for Andy? I think
so. One of the things of when I've gone into the abstracts and you got into Carried Away, you delve down. Time goes on, and then you think maybe this isn't the right path. I'm on a linear path going down. How do you backtrack, or do you just scrap it? Do you sort of destroy a few layers, or what happens? Well, you know, you're an hour, 2 hours into it. Do you ever sort of have second thoughts at that time for the next 2 hours?
But I used to get to the point where you would get so far and you were thinking, this is going nowhere. You know, yeah. It'd just be turning into a mess. Since I've been doing it like live on YouTube quite a lot, you kind of feel you've got to push through for entertainment value. So your viewers can see the end result, and you're not spending an hour of their time and you're going, actually, I don't like this. Let's start it again. I'm going to keep you here for another hour. But so now it's going, you get to the point where you can roughly guess there's a fork in the road. And it's like, well, if I go that way, there's maybe an end result. But if I'll go this way as well, what kind of end result is? So working in Photoshop in a non-destructive manner. So every layer's, you know, editable and you know, but you can go back. I'm not merging layers together and then ditching the previous 7 or 8. You know, I'm keeping all the layers so I can go back to it. And it's just a case of if you've gone down so far and you don't really like, you just knock those layers out, just make them invisible, and then, or put them into a group and then batch that off, and then, you know, go back to that point where you knew where there was that fork in the road, and then go right instead of going, you know, you choose went left. Usually I've got, you know, from the starting images, I've got a rough idea of how good it could be. So like, I'm not going to throw in 5 images on a Tuesday night on YouTube, you know, that are completely random, and not know, you know, not have a bit of confidence that I'm going to get something out of it.
So your starting point is the picture. So no other pictures get added into the mix as you go down your path. The picture.
No, pretty much it's the starting points, and I've just worked on. It's just people do ask us, like, you know, do I bring in images from like last Saturday, or I tend to only work on the images that I made in that batch. So as I'm standing on location, I'll take like 30 or 40 images. And then if I zoom out a little bit, I'll do like maybe another 20. But I'll only use, you know, a batch out of that one zoom length or that certain position I was standing in. So if I've moved slightly to the right, then I'll blend those ones together. I tend not to mix and match.
Okay, good.
I've got a random question. I mean, photography is not known as a dangerous hobby, but have you ever injured yourself wafting the camera around?
Not yet. I recently did buy a camera strap. So like it's just a wrist strap, because I had dropped it twice quite violently onto concrete. So I was like, at this point, I need to get one just to save the fact that I might have a camera left. So that was an essential purchase a couple of years ago. I was taking too many risks.
The learning curve, as it's called, yeah. Yeah.
But I do say, you know, when people come out to learn, I was like, you know, like, don't, you know, like, don't photograph as wildly as I do, because, like, you know, generally people that come to learn, they're slightly older and they're maybe not as strong in the wrist and that kind of thing. So like, just take it easy. If it's starting to ache, stop. You're like, don't injure yourself for the sake of photography.
Does anyone ever come up to you and say, you need to keep the camera still, mate, if you want to get a photograph?
I can just see, you get a few odd looks, but when you look like this, you get a few odd looks anyway. So.
I could just see some people standing saying, oh, look at that poor guy down there. He can't get still to take a photograph. Oh, that's brilliant.
You do wonder what you actually think.
Doing this. Someone wanders over and says, you want to buy a tripod, mate?
Yeah. But to be fair, it still looks better than pulling an iPad out to take a picture, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, don't advise the tripod, Neil. I can see him standing with the camera on the tripod, waving the tripod around, like, to get even wilder movement, you know?
Now that's a new angle.
Yeah, a lot of people start ICM photography on a tripod because, you know that used to using tripods for all the landscape stuff. Oh. So they put on the tripod and then the moving on the ball head or the rotation thing.
I thought you meant they were standing on a tripod trying to take it. I thought that's getting really crazy. whole new style there. I love it.
I'm guilty of doing the old, you know, the seascape, you know, off a tripod panning round.
Got to be done.
That's as far as I've gone.
Okay. Well, I'll have to have a go at this. We'll have to try. Well, listen, these guys have been waiting for years to see my moon photograph, and we're still no nearer, are we? We're still not there. So, right. Any last questions for Andy? That's fascinating, Andy. I hope our viewers can see and gauge what you've been doing there. It's a fascinating side to stuff that I know nothing about. So I'm very grateful for you coming along tonight. Boys, anything you want to say? Anything you want to add in?
No, thank you. Very interesting.
Watch this space.
Oh, there's a challenge at Neil. Great. How much involuntary movement photographs inside the house can you do? That's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, not sure it'll be done inside the house.
That salt and pepper shake is going to look remarkable, isn't it?
That'll teach you. That'll get your creative juices flowing, won't it?
Great. Okay, well, as I said, Andy, fascinating stuff. Viewers out there, if you found this interesting, and yeah, as we said earlier on, what do you think? What do you see in those photographs? That's the whole beauty of abstract work, is that a lot of people can see a lot of different things. So please send us in your comments, tell us what you think. Right, let's just have a quick word about our sponsors. I'd like to say a quick mention to our sponsors, TSO Hosts, who provide all the services that we need to get these shows out to you all. They provide all the server bandwidth we need, as well as support for our systems. They're a great company to work with. I have my own site with them. And if you need anything to do with web, design, domain names, hosting, anything like that at all, please contact them. And if you mention BTN20, they'll even give you a big discount off your first orders. Our other main sponsor here is IMN Max here in Birmingham, who are able to service and repair and upgrade any Apple kit or Apple machines that you've got. And they can even provide some really good refurbished machines with excellent value for money. And they deal with any kind of problem, actually. That's a nice bunch of guys. Just give them a ring if you have an issue, anything to do with your Macs, and I'm sure they can help you out. Well, as I said, Andy, thanks very much for that. The insight into that was intriguing, and I'm sure a lot of people will follow up. I've put the link in early in the show. I'll put it in before the end cap as well. So let's turn to the guys here. Ian, where can people get hold of you if they want to contact you?
Yeah, ianlewisphoto.co.uk.
Okay, lovely. And Neil?
You can get me at dodsyphoto.ch and dodsyphoto on Instagram.
Okay, and that'll be forwarded back to your prison cell here in the UK. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. And Damo, where can we get hold of you?
I suppose go through Damo on Instagram, and then you link into my link tree and pick everything else from there.
Okay. And Andy, what's the best way for people to look at your stuff and also get a hold of you if they want to pass any comment?
Get on the website, andrewsgray.photography, and you can find us on pretty much every social media with the handle @andrewsgray.
Lovely. Okay. I'm sure people will follow up on that. So if you want to make any comments about the show, please do. You can send them to me at martinkelly@mac.com, or you'll find most of us in the Slack room on the BTM site. You're very welcome. Come and join us there. Just drop an email to the site and we'll follow up on that. So I'm going to say good night. Good night, guys. Take care.
Good night. All.
Night.
Till Freedom Day.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, your long-awaited Freedom Day. Okay, and we'll see you all in the next show. Good night, all. Take care. Bye now.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.